Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind. Herzlich willkommen and welcome to another episode of Markenkraft. My name is Olaf Hartmann and I have the great pleasure today to speak to Mark Ritson. Mark is a brand consultant and former marketing professor. He has a PhD in marketing and taught on the MBA programs of leading universities, including the London Business School and MIT. He's writing a weekly column on marketing for almost 20 years, winning several awards for his commentaries, and he established an internal marketing academy for LVMH, the leading French luxury brand company. And he teaches, since 2017, the Marketing Week mini MBAs in marketing and brand management, which are truly the best marketing courses I ever attended. In a marketing world where often a lot of half-truths, semi-lies, or pure bullshit are being peddled, Mark is a refreshingly clear voice and whose opinion is backed up by research and a track record working with some of the most successful brands in the world. He is clearly not afraid to say how it is, and I look forward to talking to him about the state of marketing, brand strategy, and the playbook for brands in the coming recession. Welcome, Mark. Great to have you on the show.
Ah, great to be here, Olaf. Lovely to see you.
To warm up, I'll ask you just a couple of quick-fire questions. Porsche or Tesla?
Oh, Porsche all the way. I own several Porsches, old Porsches, which I'm mad about. Yeah, Porsche all the way.
A mountaintop or beach towel?
Ooh, beach. Beach wins, I'm afraid. Yeah, beach.
And on the beach, beer or wine?
Oh, it's very, very hard. I have a real passion for both. But on the beach, beer. Yeah, beer.
That's
on the beach.
Beer. Book or Facebook?
Oh, book. Book for sure.
Beatles or Bach?
Oh, that's tricky too. But Beatles, yeah, Beatles.
Steve Jobs or Bill Gates?
Bill Gates, actually. I always thought Jobs was a bit of an asshole.
Yeah, we talk about this like he never does research, does he?
Yeah.
Bill Birnbaum or Drayton Bird?
Ah, that's an interesting one. Birnbaum, I think. But Dayton's a great man, but no, Birnbaum is a legend.
Yeah, Drayton has done amazing work in direct marketing also. But Birnbaum is a different thing. What was the first job that you were paid for? You grew up in England, correct?
Yeah, I'm English. The first job I really properly did was I got a job marketing essentially ATM machines for NCR in London after I finished at university. And it was very boring and really, I think, underlined the fact that marketing was often extremely tedious if you weren't careful where you worked. So it really taught me to be cautious about where I worked in the future, you know.
That's interesting, but it was a marketing job, correct?
Yeah, always marketing. I did an undergraduate in marketing in the 80s and went into a marketing job, and that it was always what I wanted to do, which is strange, really.
That's interesting. And what was, like, going back to your childhood, do you still remember, like, the first experience or experiences that you had with brands where a choice that you made was influenced by the brand?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there weren't many brands in the 70s in the UK. I mean, it would be very much like Germany, I imagine. You know, we hadn't got to that global moment yet. And so it was really about the four or five ice cream brands that you could get occasionally, you know, and the little sweet brands that you could get occasionally. And they were still incredibly exciting and interesting, you know. But it was, yeah, I can remember being fascinated by them, even though there weren't that many and even though they weren't that interesting, frankly. So, yeah, I've always had an interest in it from the beginning.
And then you went into marketing. And marketing and advertising, I don't know how it is in Australia, but in Germany, they basically rank in popularity and trust even below, or they're even with insurance salesmen.
It's worse here and in England. Yeah, we are officially at the bottom of the league table, beneath politicians, beneath everyone, actually. So yeah, it's really bad, and probably justifiably so.
Yeah, and that would be my question. Do you think that's justified, and how did our industry end up there? And it because it wasn't always like that.
Possibly not, but yeah, I think we are totally full of shit as an industry anyway. So you have this great irony where no one believes we're trustworthy in the consumer world. Meanwhile, inside marketing, everyone's trying to have purpose and trying to be holier than thou. And they've clearly not looked out the window and seen how people perceive us. You know, it's very interesting.
Yeah, you see purpose as something like a bad conscience, huh? like of marketeers. They're not proud on their profession.
Often,
so they look for a purpose that they can talk about at dinner parties, like what they really serve.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are some cases where purpose is a genuine, you know, achievement, and they should be celebrated by brands. But a lot of the time, it's just total bullshit. Yeah, absolutely right. It's you know, Bob Hoffman has this great phrase about opening your refrigerator and looking at all the brands that you've purchased because of their purpose. You know, it's hilarious, you know. So, yeah, we get carried away with how important brands are in consumers' lives. And the reality is they're not important at all. And that's not a bad thing to say or think. It actually puts you in a position of realism, and there you can do good work, but you have to understand how unimportant your brand is to do that good work, you know.
Talking about good work, if you look back 50 years and you look at the quality of the cars that you had back then, and you step into a car today, like when you have old Porsche, yeah, you step in one of those from the 70s, and then if you have a new one and you step in that one, it's a world of difference. It's completely different. And okay, the one thing is the love for it or the atmosphere of the vintage cars, but nobody would contest that the cars today are just so much better than they used to be.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, and I think it's good to be modernist about it, right? I think most things are a lot better than they used to be, you know?
And that's my point. And that was my question, is marketing really better than it used to be?
I think yes and no. I think we've got some good data to suggest that certainly in the last 15 years, it really has gone backwards, which is quite unusual, you know? If you look at advertising effectiveness, it's less. If you look at creativity and creative effectiveness, it's not as good as it was. And so I do think there's some empirical evidence that we're not quite as good as we once were, which is quite unusual when most things are getting better. Having said that, it's very exciting, right? It's exciting to be in marketing because there's so much going on. But yeah, I do think, you can be guilty of being an old fogey and saying it's not as good as it used to be. But in the case of marketing, I think we've been entranced by programmatic and by digital marketing to such a degree that it's made us think everything's better, when in reality, a lot of this stuff isn't very good at all.
To be fair, I mean, the development technological from the technological side has been tremendous, and the amount of channels that we need to think about and so on. So the distractions definitely have grown a lot. And
it's true.
It's the look squirrel effect. Is like people in marketing are very sensitive towards, like you say, the shiny new thing. And there have been so many shiny new things, and they're still coming at a more rapid pace. You know, like
it's a concern, Olaf. I mean, if you look at what's happening with television in Germany and everywhere else, it's not dying yet, but it's declining in reach significantly in that under 40 age group. And the reason that's a concern, as you say, is we won't get something as good again. So it was possible in the era of Burnback to create advertising that hit 40, 50, 70% of the market overnight with TV. That will never happen again. We'll never get it as good again. So there's a real interesting challenge in the next 30 years of how are we going to reach these audiences when TV is still there, but not doing what it once did. And it's a fascinating question.
Yeah, that's right. And then by reaching 70% of the people, you suddenly become culturally relevant. And that is so difficult today. I mean, like you can still do that probably only with sports. Sports are one of the few things combine a lot, but otherwise, like, to really enter the cultural consciousness has become so much more difficult, which explains maybe that the money we spend in this endeavor has risen constantly. It's like I think it's at a trillion now, just on like 850 $50 billion just on media spend worldwide. And it's supposed to pass the trillion in a couple of years. And that doesn't include the creative, like the creation of the media that you do. So looking at this kind of investment, I would like to focus on your analysis or your comments on what are the most common mistakes that you see? Because obviously when you spend so much money, you want something out of it. And you just said the effectiveness has gone down. It's not coming as much out of it. So where do you see that? Where's the problem? The analysis strategy, or is it just bad execution?
No, I think it's a focus on execution that often is the problem with many brands. So we try our best with big brands to get them to think about strategy before execution. So to have a clear strategy before you start choosing your tactics, talking to agencies. And I think it's true that most brands don't have that ready. And it's not a complicated thing, really. I mean, what we're saying is a brand should be clear on who it's targeting, what its position is, and what its objectives are before it even thinks about execution. And more brands, more and more marketers simply jump to execution before they have a strategy in place. And I think that's probably the single most common error most agencies, if you give an advertising guy in Munich or London enough beer, he or she will be honest with you that the clients they're working for don't have a clear strategy. And that makes their work very hard. And I think that's something that we're seeing more and more of, a lack of strategy in many marketing teams.
And hasn't the industry then failed in explaining the importance of having a good strategy? For example, I know that you recently revamped the IPA guide for writing good briefings. And they were like, what was it, 80% or 90% of the marketeers said, yeah, we write great briefings. And 5% of the agencies said, like, our briefings are all pretty bad.
Yeah, it's stunning data, Olaf. And it comes from a very big sample. They basically said to about 1,000 senior marketers, are your briefs clear when it comes to strategy? And 80% said, yeah, super clear. And when they asked the agencies that they were briefing, 5% agreed. And most of them said there's nothing there, you know. And again, back to your point, we have data from 25, 30 years ago to show that it wasn't that bad back then. So yeah, I think we are in a place where, because we've become so obsessed with the fancy digital glitzy things, we've forgotten the fundamentals. And look, the brands that remember the fundamentals will do better. It's not, it's not something to be worried about. The great brands, the successful brands, will still have a clear strategy. But a lot of marketers just aren't capable of that anymore. And it's a shame, you know.
That is a shame. That is true. And especially if you like what you just described, is like if the digital generates like a short term, like really a short term horizon. So what can we do to help them to understand, first of all, the word strategy? Because if you ask them, so is your strategic intention clear in the briefing, and they say yes, then they might not really understand what strategy is all about.
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, the first thing is, do you have a strategy ready, right? So have you made the right choices? Have you thought about it enough? And can you answer those questions? You know, targeting is a very tricky question these days. It's, you either believe in mass marketing, or you believe in target segments, or you believe in a bit of both. But you almost have to have really thought about it first and made your choices before you can do anything else. And then you get to positioning. Most brands have overthought positioning. They have overly complex, ridiculously ornate answers to their positioning, and then they've overdone it. They've forgotten the core lesson of positioning, which is all a position is what I want my customer to think when they think about my brand. You know, it's not wheels and triangles and a high-end brand purpose. And then finally, objectives. You can't have an objective which is to double sales or become number one in the market. That's a childish thing. What are the levers? What are the four or five objectives that you want to pull that will generate success? Is it awareness? You know, is it consideration? Is it repurchase? What are we trying to do here? And when you see those three things done properly, not even perfectly, what you get is a skeleton which can drive a really successful long-term growth, but we don't see it enough anymore. And again, I think, yeah, you're right. We're working with the IPA. The goal of the Better Briefs team and myself was just to say, look, this is bad, and all the agencies know it's bad, but they're too afraid to tell the clients. So we'll tell them with the data, and hopefully everyone will get better.
Right. Can you share some two or three insights from that briefing guide to make the listeners write better briefings? So what should they look out for? What should I look out for next time I write a briefing for a creative agency?
So I think the first and most important thing is don't get too obsessed with the document. I think because of the Americans, we tend to think, a client brief is, it's all about two pages and they're getting the right boxes and all of that. The document's part of it, but a very small part. Briefing is how you select, work with, motivate, interact with your creative partners. So it's bigger than a document, first of all. The second thing is, again, be clear on your strategy and have your strategy finished. So what we find a lot of the time is companies are bringing in agencies and they're not ready yet. They keep changing their minds, and that's paralyzing for everyone. So get the thing finished. Be choiceful. If you study strategy, it's really comes down to essentially being very complex and advanced in your thinking to produce something that's incredibly simple and obvious. And when you don't think about it enough and you're not ready, your strategy is complicated, which is a sure sign that it's not a good strategy. So spend a lot of time on it, really complex, advanced thinking to produce something very, very simple. And probably the most important thing is create a relationship with your agency where you can honestly brief them and they can honestly feed back to you, where they're not clear. And that seems to be breaking down as well. Mm. But I think there are two key lessons, right? One is, do you have a strategy in place? And second, do you know how to brief? And I have no connection to the Better Briefs people. I don't, they don't pay me and I don't have any investment in them. But they run training programs which in a couple of days train people how to do briefing properly because they've worked in the industry for 30 years. And I think it's one of the most worthwhile things any marketer can do because briefing is bad, it's crucial, and a 2 or 3 day course can fix it. So I think it's one of the few areas that I would say to every marketer, get some training from agency people in how to brief better. It will serve you well,
And create the platform to brief well on. Like basically what you just described is like the secret of a better brief is do your work before. It's like really work hard on your strategy and have a clear strategy. And then writing the brief is the least difficult thing.
It should be, right? There are some cases where we've got a good strategy, but then the client team just, can't communicate it. They overdo it. But it's rare. You're right. If you've got a good strategy, you're 90% of the way there, I think. And the Better Briefs guys really think it's about briefing, and I really think it's about strategy. So we agree, but we also disagree.
Yeah, that's something that I really enjoyed getting in contact with you like 5-6 years ago for the first time. Like you spelled it out so clearly. Okay, here's this process. It's like analysis, strategy, tactics, and you can't skip any of them. If you skip one of them, everything falls apart. And so do your analysis well. And then on creating the strategy, you also said something which stuck to me is like why you have to learn to say no. No is one of the most important words in creating a great brand strategy. Can you explore for my listeners a little bit on the word no and the power of it?
Yeah, strategy is selfish. So the diagnosis part in marketing is research and segmentation, and it's about understanding the richness of the market. So you're trying to understand and draw a picture of the market. That's not up to you. But once you get to strategy, it's about making selfish choices that perhaps no one else would make but suit you. And there, I think saying no is much more important than saying yes. If we come back to the central questions of strategy, who are we targeting? If you target too many segments or too many customers, you spread yourself too thin and you lose. What is your position? If you try and position on too many things, you're throwing shit against a wall and nothing sticks. We learn this. A tight position is two or three things. And in objectives, we have lots of research from America that shows you that if you have 4 or maybe 5 objectives They have a likelihood to work, but any more than that, none of them will work because you're spreading yourself too thin. So yeah, the more you come back to it, the more clear it is that it's really as much about saying no as saying yes, because by saying no, I can focus more resources on the things that I'm saying yes to and do them properly.
Mm. And you see marketers today also to do enough research before they formulate the strategy, or you like what I mentioned before is like Steve Jobs, they refer to Steve Jobs and say, like, you know, Steve Jobs never did research, which is a myth.
It's a total myth. I mean, he had research up the wazoo in Apple. There's two kinds of marketer. There's the ones that do enough research and move on, and there's the ones that don't do any because they're paralyzed, that they find all these great arguments about why they don't want to do research. It's not scientific and I can't get a good sample and all that bullshit. Research is just getting your ass in the market and listening and watching, you know, fundamentally. So, yeah, there certainly are a lot of market. I mean, if you don't have data that's less than 12 months old, you're not really a marketer, right? You need a bit of data. And it doesn't need to cost a fortune. But our job, our prime directive as a marketer is not advertising or tactics. We're the ones that connect the company to the people that pay for everything, the customers. No one else does that. And we have to bring that understanding into the company. That's what marketing is for. The rest of it follows later. But our prime directive is to help the rest of the organization understand what the customers actually think. And we don't do that enough, you know? And again, there's room for that to be a lot better.
Right. And then the targeting immediately is informed by that. On the targeting, probably many have a question in their head because Byron Sharp is also known in Germany, not as much as in the UK and the States, but Byron Sharp is the thing that everybody talks about. And he basically says forget about targeting. That's what people understand. I know that he doesn't say that, but what people understand is forget about targeting. You know, it's all about mass marketing. Just target the whole market and that's it.
Yeah, look, and I have to give him credit. I mean, he's changed the perspective of most marketers in the world now from thinking mass marketing was always a mistake to realizing that it often works better. There's a couple of caveats, though. I mean, the first one is you have to have enough money to target the whole market. There are many German marketers thinking, yeah, sure, I'd love to target, you know, everyone in Germany. I don't have the money to do that. The other big snag, at least in my experience, is I think Sharp is correct when it comes to brand building. So if you have the money and the resources, I would target everyone when you build the brand. But when it comes to doing the performance marketing bottom of funnel things, I certainly would then be targeting more specific segments with more specific offers. So I call that two-speed targeting. I think you want to build your brand to everyone and not worry about segments. And at the top of the funnel, the best thing you can do is just make people aware of what you are and what you stand for and basically just stay in their consciousness. But down the bottom, I think to activate, it still makes sense to target often with, you know, different messages at different times with different offers. So I think there's a case for both. There's certainly more arguments for mass marketing now than there ever have been in the last 50 years in marketing. And to some degree, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it really rung a bell with me also because there are some very good case studies out there that prove that point. It's like Mateschitz from Red Bull. Like he was criticized for sponsoring the Formula One by a time where 80% of the countries where Formula One was watched, Red Bull wasn't available. And they said, well, it's like a big waste of money. It's like, no, it's not a waste. It's an investment for future markets. It creates brand salience in markets that later on, they could buy the product and some of them like several years later, but because of the Formula One presence, the brand was already there in the conscience. And so basically
it's one of the tricky things, right, about brand building is if you go back to cars again, I mean, there are advertisements that I was served 40 years ago that will have paid back, you know, now, because they built for me an image at a time when I was ready to build an image. And, you know, how do you calculate the ROI for things like that? And the answer is you don't, right? You can calculate return on investment for the bottom of funnel targeted stuff. I run this promotion, I generate this many sales. That's a great calculation. You can't do it at the top. You can't show an immediate dollar return for your brand building efforts. And everyone tries to do it, and it's a mistake. It doesn't, just because we can't show an immediate dollar value doesn't mean it doesn't have that value down the track. And I think we have to be a bit smarter about recognizing sometimes return on investment isn't the best measure simply because it's hiding a lot of the value that will happen later on.
That's a very good point. I would like to explore a little more. In one of my last podcasts, I had Paul Feldwick on, and he gave a great example of what you just described. He told me that when he was a boy, he saw this advertising for Jaguar, and it was a boy in front of a showroom, and the headline said, someday, ... And that was the first advertising contact that he remembered. And later on, actually, when he wanted to buy, when he was in the market, he bought a Jaguar because it had a deep emotional connection to it. But this is really the long game, because we're talking here 20 years in between contact with this advertising and his actual purchase intent. But the one thing is also, is like what you just said, the ROI, everything that's measurable, you always have a difficult stand then to show what the brand does for your company in the next 3 months. So how do you actually help organizations that have been put all their budgets in activation, and they also have the numbers for it? It's like, how can you switch the mindset in that organization to, we need brand building activities?
Well, first of all, you draw their attention to the fact that they're losing enormous amounts of money with this focus on ROI. And that's a statement that you have to make early. So, you know, these dreary attempts to show that, you know, if you can't justify spending this money on brand building, you shouldn't do it. It's naive and overly simplistic thinking. The lessons of Field and Burnett's work in the long and the short, it's very empirical work. You know, in consumer goods, we want about 60% of our money in the brand and 40% in the short-term performance because, and this is the key point, that will make you more money. Yeah.
Could you explain that? Because I'm sure many of the German listeners are not familiar with Field and Burnett.
So they're very important thinkers, and they become more and more influential over time. So Peter Field and Les Burnett were and still are very famous advertising planners in the UK. They have been looking at the equivalent of the Effies in the UK now, the IPA awards, all the submissions for nearly 30 years. And they've been analyzing, you know, using the data to analyze what makes for success. And one of the many things they've discovered, and they're brilliant statisticians, is that if you look for the optimum mix in, let's say, consumer goods, the best mix to make you the most money is 60% of your money on brand building and 40% spent more on performance and activation and shorter term stuff. That changes in B2B to closer to 50-50. It changes depending on the category. In banking, it's 70% brand and 30% performance. Now, the problem is, if you were to go into that, if you were working in a German packaged goods company, and overnight you said, right, we need 60% on brand and 40% on performance and sales promotions and so forth, for the first year, maybe year and a half, you might actually make less money than if you just put all of it on performance, activation, etc. Because that longer-term brand building takes a while, a year or two or three, before it starts to kick in and filter down the funnel. But if you were to take 5 years and look at each year on average, after 5 years of 60-40, inarguably, almost every time, you'd be making more money across the 5 years if you built brand and activated it in the right balance. Because at the end of the day, you know, your bottom of funnel is only doing certain things. You need the bottom of funnel to feed it as well and generate price insensitivity. So, yeah, the sad thing about companies that are driven by marketing ROI, ironically, is they're losing large amounts of money because of it.
Right. Before we get to the point, like how your advice on how to switch that mindset, besides like saying, hey, you're going to lose a lot of money, is like the financial industry you just mentioned in banks. What is your explanation why there the brand becomes even more important?
Yeah, I worked a lot with banking. It's really simple. If you live to be 80, you probably spend about a week of that 80 years actually in even any form of consideration of switching your bank. It's not like buying ice cream or cigarettes or anything where we're always buying all the time. Most of your life, you bank and you have no interest in switching. And so there's no point doing all this activation stuff because, you know, the best ad in the world isn't going to make me go, you know what, I'm going to close my accounts and move over there. So the 70% is there to build the brand for many, many years. So when that switching opportunity comes, the brand is there and it's the one you want to move to. Yeah.
Right. And it's not a category. It's a low interest category. It's probably as popular as going to the dentist. And people don't actively look for information like for cars, like you're a Porsche
fan.
No,
they're not in the market. They're not in the market. This is the best explanation I've seen. The LinkedIn guys in New York have this great data at the moment in B2B. So in business to business, it's called the 95-5 rule. 95% of, on average, in business to business markets, 95% of your customers are not in market right now. They're not interested. They don't want to buy photocopiers or corporate insurance. They're not interested. They're not in market. And so then you begin to understand why you need brands, why you don't need performance. Because for 95% of the customers, what we're doing is building brand equity, building salience so that when they do come into market later, we can activate. And then it starts to make a lot more sense, you know.
And if somebody is not in the market and not interested in the category, what is the way to get their attention? Not by pushing a message on some kind of product feature, but by entertaining them, making them laugh, giving them emotion. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Marketing doesn't make people suddenly decide they want things. I mean, it doesn't work that. It isn't that simple, right? So often the best thing we can do is, as you say, entertain, create associations, maintain salience. So when they do decide they want to switch banks or buy corporate insurance, ours is the brand that comes to mind. And most of the data of the last 10 years in B2B and B2C is clear. The brand that comes to mind first is usually the one we buy, even in B2B. If the brand comes to mind first, we'll find explanations and reasons why it's our preference. So it's all important to be there prior to the purchase need being identified. And that's the long game.
And that makes a lot of sense when you look at the psychological research now. It's like how our decision-making is informed. And we first feel something, and then it's like a post-rationalization of why that feeling is correct. So we try to be consistent because there must be a reason for that feeling. So we look for reasons that the feeling is correct, not reasons to disprove the feeling. So having that semantic memory they're talking about with connected with high emotion, then you get people in the right mood the moment they want to decide something. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you. You said in a podcast once, and that goes back to the not doing brand marketing is wasting a lot of money, or is basically you're losing a lot of money. You said once that branding is a capitalistic game, and that David and Goliath story is complete. Yeah, it's just not true that big brands, they always win. It's very, very difficult because one of the numbers that you mentioned and I wanted to ask you is like the lift, maybe to talk about the lift of a big brand and the media invest that they do.
Yeah, I mean, I blame the Americans, who I love dearly, but also think are often full of shit. So in America, there is this, it's not the same. One of the things I like about the Germans is they're far more prosaic about these things. But the Americans are convinced that the little guy can win against the big guy. You know, it's part of the American dream, you know. And that's great for movies, but it doesn't work in capitalism at all. 99.9% of the time, the little guy gets squashed by the big guy, partly because the big guy has more resources. But as you say, mostly because if you look at what generates the most advertising effectiveness, the very top of the list is how big the brand already is. Not how much it's spending, but how big it already has, because it already has existing share of mind, mental availability, physical availability, brand heritage. So it's activating these things that it's already got. That's an enormous advantage. And in the research that's been done by people like Paul Dyson at Data to Decisions, when they've looked at what drives advertising effectiveness, number two is, you know, how good is the ad? But number one, which is a factor of 16, so 16 times more important than the actual, you know, the media mix, it comes down to, is your brand already a big brand? Because you'll get 16 times more effectiveness by already being big. And you know, I often get asked when I go and talk at places, you know, many of my recommendations, they'll say, well, I own a small brand and I can't afford to do this and I can't afford to do that. So what do you say to me? And I say, I say to you that you'll stay small because that's what happens. You know, you're not going to get big because you can't afford to do the big things. You know, it's not fair. Nobody said capitalism was fair. You know, that's not how this game works, clearly, right?
That's a sad story. I'll ask you now, do you still have advice for the small dogs that want to become the big dogs?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's ways to play the risky game, first of all, right? Or find the subcategories where you can become the big guy in the small room. You know, these are still strategies that work. And, you know, do the things that big guys can't do, which is take risks, be more creative, play a specialist game. You know, you be aware of your smallness and make it a strength. I guess the biggest advantage of all for a small brand, choose a category that the big guys haven't discovered yet. You know, YouTube and Facebook, etc., are all examples of relatively recent successes because they went into categories that didn't have a big player in them when they started. You know, and I think that, you know, that's the other thing. Look for places where you can do it differently and where the big guys aren't playing or can't play yet. You know, I mean, my own business is a good example, right? I do online training. The universities are hopeless at it because they don't get it. I mean, and they have a giant infrastructure and core competence designed around populating lecture theaters. So, you know, online learning is not going to be dominated in the near term by universities because they don't get it. So it's a great place for small brands like mine to grow.
And let's stay on that topic, because I think that you've also done something which illustrates the point, because you haven't built your own brand with it. I mean, you were already well known and all that, but it's like you use the Marketing Week brand also to give it credibility and surface, right? Because that's usually the problem. It's like you don't have enough surface. But coming back just to that leverage, was I just had one insight, like why does the media invest always work so much harder for the brand? One reason is definitely because the memory structures in the heads are established. So even very slight contacts through good coding, I'm immediately triggered and create stronger memory structures that was the brand advertising.
That's
and
right.
just the fact that they advertise is a sign of strength, and that strengthens the brand. And this must be a good player. They seem to be
Olaf. You're exactly right. You're renewing existing memory structures rather than trying to create them. And in the shorter term world, you're generating a demand which can be immediately translated into a sale because you have the physical availability as well.
That's it.
Which smaller brands don't have.
And that's what most people misunderstand a little bit with when they listen to Byron Sharp and physical availability. They always think about, you know, really physical, but that's not it. It's like making the online courses accessible, like you've done with the mini MBA, is
part
of the physical availability. Tell us a little bit more about it, because like I said in the beginning, to endorse a little bit, it was honestly the best course I've ever attended. And what I was surprised at, because I was a little bit hesitant going in, is this really effective in a way? It's like, does this really replace meeting the professor, talking to other students? And I was just blown away. It was just really, really effective. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the idea, how it came about.
Great, first of all. I mean, if I can make a man like you happy, then I'm happy. I've been teaching as a professor for 25 years. I was increasingly interested in a different model that we could, I don't even want to call it online, but it was, you know, I teach old men and women, you know, an MBA school, they're 35, 45, they have kids, they have jobs. So we were teaching at weekends, you know, and it was just a shitty way to learn. You lock someone in a lecture theater at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and at 4:30 they get out and go and see their kids. And I thought, this is just bullshit, you know. And so I was messing around with it, really, and I was obsessed with marketing. We get about 600,000 visitors a month to their website. It's quite a famous marketing magazine. And I thought to myself, you know, if I run an online course, I could convert 1% of those guys to do essentially my marketing MBA course. And so I was obsessed with this, and no one wanted to do it. Everyone told me it was silly, but I was like, well, at €1,000 a head, you know, that's €6 million. You know what I mean? That's good money, you know? So I finally convinced Marketing Week to do it, and it simply worked. It worked. And what's interesting is, sure, it's more convenient for me, certainly more lucrative for me. But the thing that surprised me is it's so superior to learning in a classroom. And I never thought that would be the case. I always thought I was producing something which was kind of convenient but not as good. It is. There's no doubt in my mind that when we get a manager going on mini MBA, they learn more and enjoy it far more than doing the same thing in a classroom. And we get the same feedback again and again. You know, our net promoter score is plus 80. People love it because it's a better way for managers to learn while they're working. And that's been a real joy, a real surprise, you know?
Yeah, just to illustrate that point, because you basically pick the times where you are basically open to this. You're like, you pick times where you have nice and quiet. I often did it even on the weekend because it is actually entertaining. And
it's enjoyable.
It's very enjoyable. It's your special presentation style. And what was also very impressive is like it all ends with like simulations and real. The first one, the marketing, ends with a case study. And the second one ends with a real simulation. And where you compete with all the other brand managers. And that really makes you sweat. It really makes you sweat. And you understand.
But, people don't realize that. I said to you at the start of the course, you know, I say to everyone, this will be the most fun, but the scariest thing you'll ever do. Because at the end of the course, after 10 weeks, you run your brand for 5 years in the simulation. And if you get it wrong, you get it wrong. You know, you get your pricing wrong, you're screwed. Yep. And everyone goes, yeah, sure. But everyone loses their shit because the share price, you know, it's a very complex simulation. So, No, I wanted that. I wanted to avoid exams. You know, I wanted it to be more practical. The reason to have an exam is to learn, right? So that was always part of my game plan, to make it a more enjoyable learning experience, even the exam at the end, you know? Yeah. And it's great fun because everyone enjoys it. And the grades don't really matter, which is another great thing about not being a real professor anymore. I don't care, you know? But the learning is great. And, you know, everyone that does the course goes off and their careers go crazy, and then it's fantastic because they send you all these messages, you know, and you just feel it's a delight, you know, to be part of the transformation.
And you said you aimed originally for 6,000 participants. Where are you now with the mini MBA?
Oh, way past that. We've lost count a little bit. We've been going for 6 years, and in the early years, we weren't really keeping a good count. We're close to 30,000 alumni now in certainly 60 countries, and we keep growing. And we have two courses so far, mini MBA in marketing, mini MBA in brand management, but we'll launch a mini MBA in general management next year. So everyone that's done the marketing course, we'll now build a general course in management for marketers, which will be exciting. And we keep growing, and we've got this amazing alumni all over the world. They're all very happy, and we occasionally are going to get together. So it's a remarkable thing, Olaf. I don't know, we weren't really expecting it to be this successful, but it's great.
Yeah, and to apply it back to our topic, basically this as a small brand, you used also like one thing is like find something that nobody else can do and then connect it with also a stronger brand that gives you the access to the market. And that could be also be a strategy for smaller brands to say like, okay, do I have to be a brand myself or can I grow this into something where we can leverage a bigger brand? So congratulations, first of all, that all this worked out. Fantastic. And and now the recession is coming. You know, like we've been, you wrote a great column in the beginning of COVID. And I love that column. And I used it in our newsletter. I've quoted it very often. And it was really, it was, it was, it was, in a way, it gave you a perspective on, okay, guys, recession, you know, it's coming and it has been there before, and there's a playbook for recession. So brands that are actually able to use this, you know, they can really benefit and grow. And then two years later, we get out of COVID, and the next thing comes here in Europe, the Ukrainian war. So we get it. Like, so could you refresh that message? What brands can do to still use this constructively, get through it well, and come out stronger?
Yeah, so we've got a funny one, because we're going to go through, I don't know how things are right now in Germany, but we're going to get some form of a, perhaps not a recession, depending on how strong the economy is, but certainly, we're going to go backwards in terms of growth. And at the same time, we're going to have inflation in terms of pricing. And so it's a peculiar combination that we don't get very often. In terms of recession, the playbook is very, very clear. So we've been studying recessions for 100 years, and we see the same pattern every time, which is if you can maintain your advertising spend during the years of recession, you don't see that much advantage over your competitors who cut back. But as soon as that recession ends and we start to grow again, the impact on the growth of companies that maintained their spend during the recessionary years is spectacular, proven, inarguable. Even when we went to the GFC, and Nitin Noria, was the dean of Harvard at the time at the business school, wrote a lovely article about breaking out of the recession. He studied the companies that ended up better off after the GFC, and his main finding was they maintained their marketing spend, because we're not doing it for the short term, we're doing it for the long term. And so the reason you should maintain your brand building money is not because of the recession itself, or even because of competitors, even because of consumers. It's because your competitors are going to cut back, and you will get a much better share of voice, and you will build your long-term brand and enjoy significant growth for many years afterwards. So in recession, the message is maintain your spend, especially the brand building stuff that often is the stuff we cut back. In terms of
connected with the excess share of voice. Could you explore on that concept? Because I'm sure that's very interesting to hear from you.
Yeah, the mechanism behind it all is known as excess share of voice, which says that in most markets, there's a very strong correlation between your share of voice and your share of market. If a brand has 20% share of voice, it invariably has about a 20% share of market. If it increases its share of voice and maintains that excess, so let's say it has a 30% share of voice and a 20% share of market, we say it has an excess share of voice of 10%. Over time, the share of market will grow to match that share of voice. And this, again, is a very common pattern. What happens in a recession, though, is if you maintain your advertising spend and half the competition pulls back, you get an excess share of voice simply by maintaining your spend. And we see the same effect. And we're talking 100 years of data now. It's not something that's, an idea. It's an extremely well-established concept. And, it's easy to say, if you haven't got the money, then obviously you can't maintain your advertising spend. But all the signals are, if you have that money, one of the top priorities is maintaining brand spend, so that when the recession ends, as it surely will, you will grow significantly faster than the competition. And it's one of the inarguable principles of marketing. It's right up there.
Yeah, that's very good. And what you just said is, like, make the shift towards brand makes also a lot of sense, because if people are not willing to spend or not in the market, you can push as much as you want. You're not going to get the spend, but you can still create the memory structures that later create a positive predisposition in the moment that they think about, like when they develop a need. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. The challenge, though, for a lot of businesses going into 2023 is we also have inflation. So that has a different message. So in inflation, the problem we have is obviously that we're going to have to increase prices, or we're going to be losing money by charging the same amount of money. And the problem here is most marketers are not involved in pricing anymore. They're advertising only. And that's a real mistake, because it turns out in pricing, there are kind of three elements to pricing. There's price setting, there's the price, and then there's the way you communicate or frame the price to the consumer. It is, again, inarguable that the way we communicate price is more important than the price itself or the way in which we set it in the first place. And marketers can help you with that. So communicating a price increase, for example, is supremely important right now to get right and do it in the right way. And again, there's a playbook for how to do it. Call it a price increase. Don't try and hide, for example. Explain why you're doing it in simple terms. Remind the customer of the value that you're still offering them. You know, there's a great way to do it. And most companies aren't doing it because pricing is being run by the finance team, who just think, well, we'll just change the price. They don't get the consumer angle. So again, I think there's a real opportunity for companies who understand things on a marketing level to handle the recession better and to handle inflation better. But we need good marketers, not the ones we often find running things in some companies.
Hmm. I have a very good example of how to deal with this. It's like by a German chocolate brand. It's called Rittersport. It's like these square. You might have seen them.
I know Rittersport. Yeah, Rittersport. It's a fine chocolate bar.
Fine chocolate, and they have lots of one of their most favorite flavors is like the whole nut chocolate, and the nuts they increased tremendously in price. That's already a couple of years back, not right now. And they had like that was the time. I don't know if you noticed that the Toblerone, where they did that in the UK, where they cut every second little mountain.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you still had the same packaging, and then the chocolate came out, and every second mountain was missing.
Yeah.
That was due to the price increase also of the raw materials and also the nuts. And what Rittersport did, they examined like what makes the perfect nut chocolate, and they realized actually our chocolate would still need more nuts. So what they did, they actually added nuts and created a new class. They called it the Nussklasse, and they increased the price. Yeah, and it was a big success, and it also built the brand again. It's like it's a confident move. It's like, hey, you know what we're really about is maximizing the taste for you, and we're not. And there was also, it was then
love
above
that.
€1, which is also a difficult price point, and then it became €1.30, so 30% more expensive than it was. But
that's
it
great.
Was successful.
No, and that's the sort of stuff you want to see. I mean, I'm not saying it always has to be higher prices, but you know, price and value are, you know, they're obviously linked together. And I think if you want, the problem with most pricing when it's done by non-marketing people without any marketers present is we end up basing it off costs. We end up basing it on competition, neither of which have really got anything to do with it. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, we're pricing for value, perceived value. And if you don't have someone from marketing that understands that perceived value, then we're going to get pricing horribly, horribly wrong. I think it was McKinsey that said 90% of the time when they look at pricing that's wrong, it's underpricing, that we underprice things because we're not confident in what we offer. So I do think marketing has a role to play in price setting that, again, we need more of.
That's interesting. It leads us down one road, is like how marketing actually can communicate within an organization. Once you have the positioning, now you know what kind of mental structures you want to create, why people should remember you, what they should feel about you, and then and you only control usually the communication budget, but actually the service department needs to understand, the sales department anyway, but also the finance department on the price. Do you have any tips on how to create this kind of overall awareness? Like I always say, like brand is not a department.
Yeah, in marketing's case, it's really important that marketers realize they're not ever going to be in charge of pricing in a German company. That would not be advisable or possible. But it's also equally stupid that we don't have marketers sitting around the table when those pricing decisions are made. And that's the balance, right? Just because marketers can't control something doesn't mean they shouldn't be involved in it. Now, the problem is, and Germany, unfortunately, is no better than most countries, we have a lot of marketers that wouldn't know what to do if they were invited around the table to talk about price. They're essentially advertising specialists. Mm-hmm. So we need two things. We need marketers that actually understand all the tactical levers. Yes, it's communications, but also understand distribution and product development and pricing. And then we need companies to say, you're not in charge of pricing, but where's the marketing people? Let's ask them about value, about price research. You know, let's have the customer present through the marketing team in the pricing decisions. And it's not happening. It's really not happening at the moment because we don't have demand for it and we don't have the marketing quality of supply. But again, for the companies that can do this, there are big advantages to be had.
Right. Yeah. So they need to just learn to speak the language of also the finance department.
Maybe, Olaf, but more basically, marketing was never meant to be communications only. If you run the numbers on it and you know what you're talking about, advertising and communications is roughly about 7 or 8% of the total marketing challenge, right? If you understand the full scope. Pricing is more important than communications, yeah, and its impact on the business. So it isn't even learning the language of the finance team. It's remembering what marketing is meant to be about. You know, it's not meant to be just communications. We have a generation that don't do research, don't understand strategy, can't be involved in pricing, don't understand product development. All they want to do is digital communications. It's a tiny fraction of what marketing can do for a business.
Hmm. And even within the communication, the digital is only one part. Yeah. And
it's right.
And also place. Like if you think about, like I think in luxury brands, this is the sensitivity is much higher because every sales director of, for example, Chanel would not allow you to sell Chanel lipsticks at the railroad station. Yeah. Because everybody knows what this does to the brand and the perception of the product. Yeah. So all this is included. So the place also is an important signal like that shapes the perception of the brand. So
totally,
why should the marketing not be part of the discussion, which distribution partners is going to be the right one for us and who to take on and who not to take on.
Well, look at the number of brands that went straight into supermarkets in Germany because that's where all the customers were. And what they did, to your point, failed to realize was unless you build the brand outside of supermarkets first, you have no hope once you're in supermarket distribution of building brand. You know, you're in trouble. You know, it's a marketing insight, you know, that you build brand outside of the supermarkets before you go in. But if you run by salespeople, you won't get that point, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There's also a good example from Germany, which was a drink, Bionade, and it was like a rebel lemonade. It was the first ecological lemonade, and it was first sold in Hamburg in the really like the cool bars, and it was like a little bit about counterculture and revolution. The official drink of a better world. That was one of the slogans that they used. The official drink for a better world, and then the owner family sold it to a big beer company in Germany. And they had amazing distribution afterwards because obviously the beer company had a huge sales force, but the sales went down because the core of the brand was damaged. It was the meaning of the brand changed.
You can survive that. You know, I used to work on Dom Perignon where it was, you know, Costco was a very big customer in the States. But the lesson is you have to balance it out. For every sale you get in Costco, you need to be very prominent in top tier distribution networks elsewhere. You know, you can balance it out. But if you just take the money and you don't reinvest it, then yeah, things go wrong.
Right. Talking about Look Squirrel, the shiny new thing, I would like to get your take on the metaverse at the end.
Yeah.
Because, Mark, an hour has gone by like this. It evaporated in podcast time. So as a last segue, like give us your take on the shiny new thing, the metaverse.
Oh, look, it's the latest temptation for marketers that don't want to do marketing. Yeah. NFTs, the metaverse, 3D printing. We've been down this road before, VR headsets. We have this eternal attraction to shiny things. The metaverse is clearly a massive thing. It already exists in computer games, by the way. It's just that marketers don't realize that. we're always chasing the next thing. And at some point, the metaverse will have dramatic impacts. But my point is, for most marketers in the next 12 months, it will have absolutely zero impact. I mean, there's a great case study at the moment with one of the big dating companies, online dating companies that invested heavily in NFTs and in the States, and then invested in the metaverse. And in the end, the chairman had to fire the CEO because he's like, "What are we doing? You know, this is nonsense. We're not, you know, we're a grown up site. You know, there's a future in the metaverse, but we have to focus on the business at hand right now. You know, so there's Tinder spending a fortune on, you know, online NFTs and you know, metaverse strategies. Meanwhile, they've got to make money. You know, so yeah, I think it's a great temptation. It's a great distraction. And the only advantage is if you meet marketers that talk about NFTs or the metaverse a lot, it's the best way to identify people who aren't very good at marketing.
but you were successful selling NFTs, huh?
That was a big sale. I made a lot of money there.
Tell us about that. What did you do? Are they still available? How much did they cost?
No, they were sold. I got so bored with all this bullshit about NFTs that I took three different photographs of me sitting on the toilet and sold each of them as an NFT. And they actually did make quite a lot of money. I was quite impressed. I have no idea what happened to them. I don't know how they're being used.
So you didn't put in a smart contract that you earn every time it's resold.
Don't really understand what I was doing, Olaf. I got onto some sites and got some blockchain or something, and then someone gave me 400 euros, and I'm like, yeah, I'll take that, you know. But to this day, I don't really understand what happened. To be fair. Okay. Except someone's got a picture of me sitting on a toilet somewhere, which they're more than welcome to. And if any of your listeners would like another one for 400 euros, please get in touch. There's as many of those in NFT form as you might want.
I put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, please do. Open for business.
Open for business. One resource we pointed already to, the mini MBA in marketing and brand management. Another resource I would like to point the listeners to is your weekly column, which is free. You don't have to subscribe
super
to
free,
Marketing
yep.
Week, super free, very inspiring every week. So that works a lot. What other resource would you like to point our listeners to, which makes sense?
I'm a big fan of a couple of things. So I really would recommend that your listeners have a look at the B2B Marketing Institute, which is run by LinkedIn. There are a couple of students of the mini MBA who have done a brilliant job of building the Byron Sharp stuff in the B2B world. So for marketers that work in business to business, I think it's a brilliant resource. Lots of thought papers, lots of data, brilliantly done. So I'd say that's a place to go and have a look. Just generally the Marketing Week site. I mean, Germany is a fascinating market, you know. You have such advanced corporate and industrial skills, and yet marketing, it's never quite there. You know, I'm fascinated by it. You must see it. Like, you've got a very small number of very good marketers. And then it's sort of, I don't get where marketing sits in a German firm often. Do you know what I mean? For such industrial skills.
Absolutely.
You know, and
absolutely.
I think it's great industrialists of Europe. And yet marketing just isn't on the radar, it seems, you know.
Well, they used to be a very long time ago. The first, like the big brands like Siemens or the cigarette brands, Remsmar, they were very, very marketing prone. I mean, they really knew, and they were at the top of the decision ladder. You know, they were the owners or the managing directors, and they knew a lot about marketing. But somehow it has gone somewhere. We might have to do a search quad for it. It's like what happened to it? It's often dominated by engineering, finance, law, and it really, I think that it needs, in my view, a renaissance, because to be honest, like, we used to be successful because we built the best products in the world. but there are other countries now that match us on any technological level easily. And what still protects us is the brand, the German engineering brand, the trust that people put in this. So the skill of building brands and creating meaning for products, which are otherwise exchangeable, is like for our whole country, a very, very important skill and definitely deserves more recognition than we actually have right next to insurance salesmen, because it's very complex. It's super complex, and it really needs more visibility and support.
It is, as you say. I mean, it's such an attractive, I mean, you know, the country itself, you know, is such an attractive place. But you know, just the department. I mean, I could spend the rest of my life happily wandering around German department stores, drinking German beer, eating German food. You know what I mean? It's spectacularly good quality. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's.
Have you worked in Germany? Have you worked in Germany? Did you do project in Germany?
I worked a little bit. I worked a little bit for Roche for a few years, and that was in Mannheim. But I spent a lot of travel time. I used to go to Munich a lot for holidays just because I liked Bavaria. So yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of Germany. I genuinely find it to be one of the more nice places in the world. Mm. And Germans are terrific people. You know what I mean? They're sort of. It's hard to describe. I had a wonderful night once at a motorway service station in Antwerp, and it was me and a bunch of Germans and a bunch of Dutchmen, and we were all drinking heavily. I think it was a Friday night, and everyone was going in different directions, but we got very, very drunk, and we all went outside and started smoking cigarettes. And it was this lovely moment where these three nationalities that don't always get on began to realize that there was a sort of Saxon link to all three cultures. You know, we'd all just eaten a lot of food, drank a lot of beer. Now, none of us were cigarette smokers, but we were smoking cigarettes. And the similarity of the three races, I think, is very, you know, it's very apparent to me. You know, we all hate each other on the sporting fields a lot of the time, but I'm much more comfortable with the Germans. I love the French, but I don't understand them, whereas I understand the Germans and I like hanging out with them, you know? So I think that part of culture, of the German culture, is wonderful, you know?
Yeah. And like you said, it's like, I think that we are too proud on invention and patents on some kind of invention. But the problem is the patent runs out after 20 years. A brand just goes on to become stronger and stronger and stronger. So we need that reconsideration. So maybe this podcast
I remember that the moment that I think the best moment ever, Olaf, I saw that was I was working with for LVMH for many years, and Mr. Arnault, the founder and owner of LVMH, was on French TV, and Apple had just become the world's most valuable brand. And they asked him about it. And, you know, he was talking about something else, but they asked him about it, and he couldn't resist. He's a very interesting man, Mr. Arnault. And he said, oh, yes, he's very impressive, very impressive. But he said, I wonder in 100 years if people will still be using the iPhone. And he said, because I'm pretty certain they'll still be drinking Dom Perignon and carrying Louis Vuitton bags. And it was a very, very, very nice way of saying the strongest brands have that eternal life, you know what I mean? Which, you know, as Porsche have demonstrated with the Taycan, you can live on, you know, despite the ruptures. And I think that's absolutely. The two things about brands we forget, I think, especially with the Ehrenberg Bass influence, which is more about sales, the price premium that you get for a stronger brand needs to be talked about more. And your point, which is just the long-term health of the organization when you have brands and brand extension, these are the two biggest arguments for brand building, right? They're more than sales. You have eternal life if you don't screw things up, and you have significantly more profit.
Yeah, totally. So maybe this podcast helps a little bit to spread the word. Brands are really worth investing in, but you still need innovation as well. Yeah. So I know you once said that writing a book is not for you, but a question, is there any kind of book that you've gifted often?
Yeah, look, I'm a big fan, particularly it's summertime in Germany. You want to read the Good Strategy, Bad Strategy by Richard Rommel. That's a great book. Because it's actually very readable. It's a good book. They have a German, I'm pretty sure they have a German version too. So yeah, Good Strategy, Bad Strategy is a lovely book to read. Very, very addictive and reading.
And the author was, I didn't catch the name.
Richard, awesome. I think, is it Rummelt? I've forgotten his name.
We put it in the show notes afterwards. We put the link in the show notes.
I think it's Richard something, Rummelt or Rummelt. I get his name mixed up. But yeah, it's a wonderful book and it's well worth a read.
Great. Now, my last question. You have the chance to put on all the screensavers of people responsible for brands in Germany. You can put something on there for 1 month. What would it say?
Oh, look, it's very self-serving, but I would say the thing about being a brand manager is you can be trained in brand management and you can get really good at it. So come and do mini MBA in brand management, you know, or something else if there's something as good. You know, brand management is a skill that is a guild that you can learn how to do it properly. And I think we need more well-trained brand managers. And that's the thing brand managers should realize. Yeah? Training makes you good.
Okay. So it says get trained, yeah, become confident, click here. So that's going to be on
exactly.
the screen today.
Exactly. Couldn't do it by myself. That's perfect.
Excellent. Mark, my sincere thanks for your time and the great conversation. This was really fun and very valuable advice. I wish you all the best with the mini MBA, and I'm sure it will continue to thrive and help people really become better brand marketers. And I hope you continue to have fun with it.
Danke. Dankeschön.
Und das war eine weitere Episode von Markenkraft. Vielen Dank, dass Sie dabei waren. Wir hoffen, es hat Ihnen genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlen Sie uns, Ihren Freunden, Ihren Bekannten, Ihren Kollegen und bewerten Sie uns auf iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, egal wo Sie diesen Podcast hören. Share the love for brands. Machen Sie es gut für sich und die Menschen in Ihrem Leben.